Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. China has warned about the impact on global trading if U.S. President Trump proceeds with his plans to impose tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. Meantime, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has continued to say any U.S. tariffs on steel and aluminum imports would be unacceptable, and he vowed to continue to engage with U.S. officials on this issue.
We are impressing upon the American administration the unacceptable nature of these proposals that are going to hurt them every bit as much as they will hurt us. And we are confident that we're going to continue to be able to defend the Canadian industry.
British Prime Minister Theresa May has said she is confident that a deal on leaving the European Union can be reached, but she warned no one will get everything they want out of Britain's pending departure, known as Brexit. Britain is due to leave the bloc in March of next year, but wants a two-year transition period to help businesses adapt.
Under pressure to deliver details, Theresa May's speech was billed as a major step on the road to Brexit.
We all need to face up to some hard facts. We're leaving the single market. Life is going to be different. In certain ways, our access to each other's markets will be less than it is now.
Europe has said it will not allow Britain to cherry-pick the best bits of EU membership. May countered that she wanted the deepest possible relationship.
That is Henry Ridgewell reporting for VOA News. It appears the hostilities between the U.S. and North Korea are escalating once again after it appeared at the Winter Olympics would be some type of peaceful accord, with South Korea engaging in the mediation. North Korea has now warned it would respond if the U.S. holds joint military drills next month, and with South Korea contending they would hinder the recent thaw in relations between the two Koreas. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson will be traveling to Africa next week, where he will meet with leaders of various African nations. State Department spokesperson Heather Nord.
Secretary Tillerson will meet up with leadership in each country, as well as the leadership of the African Union Commission based in Ethiopia, to further our partnerships with the governments and the people of Africa. In particular, he plans to discuss ways that we can work with our partners to counter terrorism, advance peace and security, promote good governance, and spur mutually beneficial trade and investment.
The United States recently put several affiliates of the Islamic State terror group in Africa on the terrorism blacklist. Nathan Sales is the State Department Ambassador at Large and Coordinator for Counterterrorism.
Africa has traditionally been an area in which terrorist groups have operated. And part of the reason for that is because they assess that they're able to move across borders undetected. What we've tried to do is stand up the capabilities not just of military authorities in the region, but also border security authorities and law enforcement authorities in the region.
Secretary Tillerson's trip is also seen as a good opportunity for the U.S. to reaffirm ties with African nations. United Nations aid agencies are gearing up for the first delivery in months of desperately needed humanitarian assistance to thousands of people trapped in the besieged Syrian enclave of eastern Ghouta. Syrian authorities finally have given permission for the UN envoy, or convoy, to enter the city of Douma Sunday. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The convoy will be carrying food, medicine, and other crucial relief supplies from a number of UN and international agencies for 180,000 people. The UN Children's Fund, which is part of that convoy, will have supplies on board for 70,000 children. Gert Capillare, UNICEF Regional Director for the Middle East and North Africa, says nutritional and health supplies are a priority given the alarmingly high number of malnourished children in eastern Ghouta.
The U.S. Secret Service says a man shot himself outside the White House and medical personnel arrived on the scene. President Trump is not at the White House. He's in Florida, but he is set to return later Saturday. The agency says in a Twitter post that there are no other reported injuries related to that incident. Seven Italians detained in connection with the murder of an investigative journalist have been released by Slovak authorities. They were taken into custody Thursday as part of an investigation into the murder of 27-year-old Jan Kuciak and his girlfriend, who were found shot dead in their home near the Capitol Sunday. Kuciak was about to publish an article on alleged high-level political corruption in the Italian city of Calabria, connected to the criminal mafia, in which he named the suspects all businessmen. Investigators said that his death was most likely linked to his reporting. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impoga. Peter Clote is on assignment.
Record UN Security Council Resolution 2372 of 30th August 2017, whose main thrust was the phased reduction and drawdown of arms and troops by 2020.
Nations contributing troops to the AMISOM peacekeeping mission in Somalia call on the UN Security Council to keep troops slated for removal by the year 2020.
His spokesman said the ban on the coronation is unjust, arbitrary, and unconstitutional. He said Bulelani Khumalo's supporters will take legal steps to ensure the right to freely practice their culture. Local chiefs pledge to push ahead with the coronation.
A Zimbabwean court stops a planned coronation of a new Ndebele king, saying the monarchy is unconstitutional.
What we get out of this meeting will contribute to the way we assist, really, victims of trafficking, and also the way we identify victims of trafficking.
And a UN agency starts training staff in Southern Africa on ways to combat trafficking in persons. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. The five East African nations contributing troops to the AMISOM peacekeeping mission in Somalia have called on the UN Security Council to keep troops slated for removal by 2020. Halima Athman has the story for VOA from Kampala.
The AMISOM Regional Peacekeeping Mission to Somalia has over 20,000 soldiers from Uganda, Kenya, Burundi, Ethiopia, and Djibouti. The withdrawal of AMISOM troops is slated to begin this year. Heads of state from the five countries met with Somalia's president and regional officials in Kampala Friday. The countries reaffirmed their commitment to continue to assist the federal government of Somalia in its stabilization effort. They warned that the planned drawdown of AMISOM troops endangers hard-fought gains made since the force first deployed to Somalia in 2007, with more than 80% of the country's territory recovered by the Somalia National Army and AMISOM. However, the political and security situation in Somalia remains fragile. In a communique read by Uganda's Foreign Minister, Sam Kutesa, the heads of state took a position.
Record UN Security Council Resolution 2372 of 30th August 2017, whose main thrust was the phased reduction and drawdown of AMISOM troops by 2020, and observed that the time frames and troop levels under UN Security Council Resolution 2372 are not realistic and would lead to a reversal of the gains made by AMISOM. Noted that the drawdown undermined the capacity of AMISOM to deliver its mandate, and further noted the inadequate capacity of Somali National Army and the importance of hastening the formation of the Somali National Security Forces.
One of the main issues of concern for the troop contributing countries has been the inadequate funding of AMISOM, which was the basis for the call last year to draw down troops. Somali President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed has pledged to rebuild the National Army.
But I believe we have a long way to go. We need to put together a sound strategy in order to effectively fight against Al-Shabaab and defeat them. If we continue to collaborate with the help of EU and international community to continue funding this operation, we will be able to defeat Al-Shabaab in a very short order.
Al-Shabaab militants continue to carry out frequent attacks. The group carried out Somalia's deadliest terror attack ever in October of last year, a truck bombing in Mogadishu that killed more than 300 people. However, regional leaders meeting in Uganda stressed the threats in Somalia also stem from other armed groups and from communal infighting. African Union Commission President Moussa Faki Mahamat.
There is no doubt that we need to continue sustained military operations. Most importantly, we must also address in a comprehensive manner the causes of radicalization, continued recruitment, and localized grievances and conflict.
Emphasis was also put on the need to provide more than 5.4 million people in Somalia with life-saving humanitarian assistance. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Zimbabwe's High Court has ruled that a monarchy is unconstitutional, which means the planned coronation of a new Ndebele king cannot proceed. The coronation was planned for today. For VOA, Ade Gondo in Bulawayo has more on the movement to bring back an old kingdom.
Bulelani Lobengula Khumalo had arranged to be crowned king on Saturday. The government says the ceremony in Bulawayo cannot go forward because it is unconstitutional. His spokesman said the ban on the coronation is unjust, arbitrary, and unconstitutional. He said Bulelani Khumalo's supporters will take legal steps to ensure the right to freely practice their culture. Local chiefs pledged to push ahead with the coronation. Interest in reviving the kingdom that colonial settlers overthrew 124 years ago has grown since President Robert Mugabe was ousted last year after 37 years in office. But it's a complicated effort. Ulelani Khumalo is one of three claimants to the throne. The other claimants are Stanley Raphael Khumalo, who has demanded the government give him the keys to the Bulawayo State House, and Peter Zwide Kalanga Khumalo, who introduced himself as a king at a gathering at Bulawayo's amphitheater a few weeks ago. The men and their supporters say re-establishing the monarchy would unify the people of Matabeleland region and protect the minority Ndebele culture. Efi Ncube is the spokesperson for Bulelani Khumalo.
The monarchy is of tremendous use, provided it operates within the principles that people are agreed on. Like the principles that are applied in the constitution that espouses or enshrine the rule of law, the supremacy of the constitution, the respect for the constitution, the respect for the equality of the people, the unity of the people, respect for the freedoms of expression of.
Several African nations have tribal kings who operate under a national government, and some states have national monarchies. Some legal scholars say Zimbabwe's constitution is silent on monarchies, and it is not clear the government has the power to ban coronations. But it is also not clear how a monarchy could function in the country under the present circumstances. Reverend Paul Bayete Damasane is a cultural analyst and principal director in Zimbabwe's Ministry of Sports, Arts and Culture. He says the constitution does not bar a group from its cultural practices, I beg your pardon, as long as they don't impinge on other people's culture. But it would be hard, he says, to put a monarchy into practice.
The question that one would ask is, do you need a new political disposition and structure than the one that we have? And my posture on that one is, I don't think it is even possible to even fathom that thing.
Given the battered economy, many Zimbabweans wonder what use a monarchy could have, especially since it would require tax funds to run. Nkosinesi Samate is among those with doubts about the idea of restoring a long-lost kingdom.
I feel like it's something that's irrelevant to our generation because I can't really find how it relates to the current governance structure and how it's going to contribute to that and make a difference in my life as a young person living in the current Zimbabwe.
There are also concerns that reviving monarchies could worsen ethnic tensions given the growing secessionist movement in Matabeleland. Reporting for VOA from Bulawayo, this is Adi Gondo.
Nasser Ayoub is a famous Sierra Leonean musician and hotel owner. My colleague Peter Kilote caught up with him in the capital Freetown to get his take on when is this general election and the and overall political climate in the country.
So, Lassa, you are a businessman and a musician and a Sierra Leonean.
Yes.
Wednesday, prospective Sierra Leoneans go to vote for their choice of president, parliament, local council, and all that. Currently, what would you say is the current situation, political situation in the country? Your views.
Well, my personal view is, you know, the current, you know, situation, I think is very calm. I mean, we just saw three rallies, you know, the biggest rallies took place a few days ago. And there was no, you know, injuries, there weren't, you know, fatalities. And so far, so good, I can say.
So far that you've seen all these big political parties, some are running independent, minor political parties. Who do you think would win? Or do you think there could be a possible runoff? Give me your view.
Well, again, personally, you know, this is my personal view. You know, looking at the rallies that just took place, you know, we all know that, you know, if we were to count on, you know, the size of the rallies, I think one of the potential winners are the current, you know, regime, I would say. But again, you know, with regards to the runoff, I think there might be a possibility, you know, because the total numbers of registered voters is just, you know, 3.1 million. And the Constitution says you need 55% and above to win. So if I should calculate that, it's like 1.7 million. And to get 1.7 million is a miracle, I would say. But fingers crossed, you know, all we pray for is a non-violence election. Whereas, you know, if it ends with first round, very good. And if it goes to the runoff again, I just pray and hope that, you know, we would go back again to the drawing board and preach non-violence and, you know, maybe the best win.
Do you think these political parties have done enough to prevent or advise their supporters not to engage in acts of violence? Because some people I spoke with are expressing concern that there could be violence despite the fact that the situation is calm.
Exactly, despite that the situation is calm, I think most of them have done enough, you know, with regards to the non-violence saga. But I believe, you know, Sierra Leoneans have gone through a lot with Ebola and the war. So I don't think, you know, a Sierra Leonean listening to me right now would actually encourage his brother or sister to go down and, you know, start violence just because of, you know, election results.
Are you comfortable with the way the Electoral Commission has carried itself so far in terms of educating the masses, in terms of organizing the elections, in terms of bringing on board all the political actors to address their concerns before Wednesday's election?
Definitely. And in fact, just yesterday, all the political parties, you know, signed a memorandum which prevents, you know, violence and hatred speech, etc., etc. And don't forget that we have so many big players who are monitoring this election with regards to ECOWAS and the EU and the US. You just name them. You know, they're all here on the ground. And they are also making sure that, you know, they get the best out of the best.
I was Nasser Ayoub, a Sierra Leonean musician and hotel owner. He spoke with my colleague Peter Clote in the Sierra Leonean capital of Freetown. French President Emmanuel Macron's groundbreaking vow to return colonial-era artifacts to Africa may face its first test next week, when he holds talks in Paris with his Beninese counterpart Patrice Talon. At issue are treasures from the former kingdom of Dahomey, which ended up in French museums and private collections. If the Macron government makes good on its promise, experts say it might prove a tipping point for other European countries facing similar restitution demands. But as Lisa Brandt reports for VOA from Paris, the practicalities of reparations are both complicated and controversial.
The Quai Branly Museum in Paris holds thousands of African artifacts, Quelle masks from Gabon, Cameroon, and Republic of Congo, Baole and Dan sculptures from Côte d'Ivoire, and royal Dahomey artifacts from what is modern-day Benin. Like those elsewhere in Europe, France's top public museum for African art is now reconsidering its collection amid rising questions about whether some of it was looted or otherwise unfairly acquired from former colonies.
Je ne peux pas accepter qu'une large part du patrimoine culturel de plusieurs pays africains.
Restitution claims are not new, but now President Emmanuel Macron is giving them new impetus. During a keynote speech in Ouagadougou last November, he said Africa's cultural heritage could no longer remain in European museums and private collections. Over the next 5 years, he said, artifacts in France must be temporarily or permanently returned to Africa.
With Mr. Macron, the debate has started in France.
Mechthild Ressler heads UNESCO's World Heritage Center in Paris.
Each of the museums needs to have a look at their own collections and identify pieces which may have been trafficked illegally or which may have come out of some dubious circumstances during colonialism.
In 2016, Benin became the first African country to ask France for its artifacts back. Several thousand pieces taken from the former Kingdom of Dahomey by French soldiers and missionaries. A number ended up at Quai Branly. But the answer by the previous French administration was no. The art was now French property. Beninois, like Marie-Cécile Zinsou, reject that argument. She heads the Zinsou Foundation in Cotonou, which promotes African art.
Benin heritage is shown in France. It's shown in New York. It's shown in London. It's shown in Berlin. The only place where you can't see it is Benin, because the French, they left with everything.
There's also a powerful economic dimension. Art attracts tourists, like the millions coming to Paris each year. And tourists, notes Louis-Georges Tain, bring money. Tain heads CON, an umbrella group of French Black associations and a key restitution campaigner.
If you want tourists to come to your country, you need to have a cultural legacy to show to the world. And how can you do that when most of your legacy has been robbed by many people in the Western countries?
Some critics argue African art is now universal patrimony and that many African countries don't have the facilities to house old and fragile artifacts.
Ça, c'est l'école, la première chose que nous avons fait au Bénin.
Others believe these issues can be resolved. A group of Paris galleries, for example, built a small museum in Benin, donating art from their own collections. Gallery owner Robert Valois led the effort.
Something has to be done. The doors are open to discussion, you know, between people of bonne volonté.
Valois believes one solution would be to keep the art in European museums for now, where it's well-preserved, but ensure it travels widely in Africa. He considers the artifacts as national treasures for both France and Africa. What's important, he says, is that the public in both places has access to them. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Meanwhile, the United Nations International Organization for Migration has started training its staff in southern Africa on ways to combat trafficking in persons. The United States is helping in the effort to fight a growing crime. Sebastian Mhofa has more from Harare for VOA News.
Last year, the International Organization for Migration, IOM, helped the cash-strapped Zimbabwe government bring back more than 200 women stranded in Kuwait after they had been trapped in human trafficking schemes. But the IOM wants to do better. In Zimbabwe, human traffickers target people with promises of jobs or scholarships abroad. They then ask people pay their airfares and some administration fees. They then dump them upon arrival in the promised land, where they are often forced in servitude or the sex trade. This week, the IOM worked with staffers to help them learn, among other things, to check advertisements of scholarships and jobs abroad and verify their authenticity. The staff also learned ways to better communicate with the traumatized victims, get them into appropriate shelters, and help them recover. Lidisanya is the IOM Chief of Mission in Zimbabwe.
And I hope that what we get out of this meeting will contribute to the way we assist, really, victims of trafficking, and also the way we identify victims of trafficking.
Trafficking is an issue that continues to be very challenging to address, because as soon as you nab one group of traffickers, they come up again.
The IOM training also aims to equip officials to spread awareness to vulnerable groups on the signs of potential traffickers, and it teaches staff how to reintegrate victims who are repatriated. At the start of the training this week, the U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe, Harry Thomas Jr., called trafficking in persons, quote, modern-day slavery, unquote, which targets mainly women and girls.
Human trafficking has become a $150 billion industry, and I expect it's going to grow. It touches millions of lives across the globe. Trafficking is a hidden crime, making it extremely difficult to quantify. However, there are an estimated 20 million victims that we know of. It will take a global effort to effectively combat it. We can achieve a great deal by raising awareness through programs aimed at warning vulnerable populations of the risks of trafficking.
Thomas says the U.S. Department of State has committed more than $2 million to enable Zimbabwe and the Southern African region to start various initiatives to eliminate trafficking. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Italians are preparing to cast their ballots on Sunday in a general election observers say has a highly unpredictable outcome. In a country where frustrations are running high over unprecedented levels of migrant arrivals, anti-establishment parties are thriving. A large number of Italians are still undecided over how they will vote, and this time they will be casting their ballots with a new electoral system many do not even understand. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA.
One major issue has dominated the Italian electoral campaign: immigration. The debate ahead of Sunday's elections, the first national vote since 2013, has highlighted growing racial tensions. More than 600,000 people have arrived in this country from North Africa in the past 5 years, and there has been growing discontent among the population over how the government has been dealing with the migrant emergency. Right-wing parties, including the League and its leader Matteo Salvini, have advocated mass expulsions, and this has led to concerns among the migrants that have made it to Italy, some facing horrific hardships along the way. Mohamed Tijawi is a 17-year-old from Ghana, terrified that he may have to go back to a land that has nothing to offer him.
They are saying that after the election, they will take back to our country. So we are begging to the Italian government to help us.
The horrific killing and dismemberment of an Italian woman at the hands of Nigerians in the town of Macerata last month has the African community in Italy extremely concerned with what will occur next. Alfian Ze is a Nigerian filmmaker who has lived in Milan for many years.
The foreign community, especially the Africans that I know of, you have this feeling like you're hoping from day to day that nothing, no crime is committed in Italy in this period by an African.
Nze believes there is a growing sense of paranoia among Italians, fed by a political class that is using the immigration issue as a useful distraction. Italians, he says, are focusing on the number of migrant arrivals instead of the real problems that need urgent attention in this country, like the lack of jobs for young people and an economy that has shown some signs of recovery, but very slowly. The Nigerian-born filmmaker adds that never has he felt this unsafe as a black man in Italy.
You really have the feeling that, yeah, you have to watch your back while you move the streets of Italy today. And sometimes, personally, I avoid going to events where I know I have to come home at night and alone, you know. And that has never happened in over 20 years of living in Italy.
Former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, who is banned from running for office, has emerged as an unlikely kingmaker showing a united front of his Forza Italia party with the League and the Nationalist Brothers of Italy party. Berlusconi recently said that undocumented migrants in Italy are all ready to commit crimes, creating a social bomb about to explode. Anne Robichaud is an American tour guide married to an Italian who has lived in the central region of Umbria for 40 years. She says, across the country, Italians feel there is no positive aspect that comes with the wave of foreigners arriving in search of a better life.
There's this aura that they're coming in, they're taking our jobs, they're dealing with drugs, they're a threat to the Italians.
She says the Italian situation is not dissimilar to what has been happening in the United States with the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program and the so-called Dreamers.
Salvini, the same thing. He's almost a repetition of America first. His cry now is Italia first.
Legitimate concerns have existed for some time in Italy around mismanagement, corruption, and inadequate integration measures. In addition, the failure of other European Union countries to share responsibility with Italy for those arriving has also fueled anti-European sentiment in the run-up to the vote. Observers say that with the existing political fragmentation, the most likely outcome is that no coherent parliamentary majority will exist after March 4th, paving the way to a provisional government and an all-too-common scenario of instability in Italy. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. And see to come in the program, the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from across the continent. But first, let's take a look at highlights at the ongoing IAAF World Indoor Championships, Birmingham 2018. Ethiopia's world record holder Genzebe Dibaba held on her time of 8 minutes and 45 seconds to win the third straight world indoor title. The energetic Andy Edwards reports for VOA from Birmingham.
The way Genzebe Dibaba is running, she's going to need a whole new trophy cabinet to accommodate her medal collection, and the majority of them will continue to be golden. Indoor competition appears to bring out the best of her, the tight turns and bends suiting her physique and devastating finishing speed. The women's 3,000 metres was a straight final and offered plenty of quality all round. Kenya had their world 5,000 metre champion, Helen Obiri. Sifan Hassan of the Netherlands is a renowned fast finisher, and Britain's Laura Muir was a double European indoor champion last year. The pace for the opening 2 kilometres was nothing special, but Dibaba turned up the heat for the last 1,000 metres. Obiri looked in the shape to follow, so did Hassan and Muir, but the Ethiopians' lead grew. Dibaba came under pressure on the final lap, but had enough in reserve, leaving Sifan Hassan with silver and Laura Muir with bronze. One half of the intended double had been achieved, and Genzebe Dibaba gave a concise verdict before concentrating on the 1500-metre qualifying round on Friday evening.
Yes, I'm very happy about today. This one is a four-time World Indoor Champion. I'm very happy.
The final proved disappointing for Helen Obiri. The Kenyan faded to finish a distant fourth, just holding off Shelby Houlihan of the USA. Obiri recognised what a force Dibaba has become, but hopes for success at the Commonwealth Games in Australia next month.
I think I'm looking forward to do Commonwealth. We have Commonwealth in Gold Coast next month. I think I'm going to do quite good because it's my first time to miss a medal, and I'm going to look forward at least to win there.
Two high jump finals completed the first day's competition, and they also offered competition to savour. Daniel Lysenko, one of the Russians competing under the banner of authorised neutral athlete with respect to the ban on Russia, reversed the outcome of last year's World Outdoor Championships in beating Mutaz Basim of Qatar. Lysenko was superb in reaching 2 metres 36, while Basim, also impressive, cleared 2.33. Germany's Mateusz Sibylko reached new heights with 2.29 for bronze. Maria Lazitskine was odds-on favourite for the women's high jump, and so it proved, the only one to clear 2 meters. Another of the Russians competing under a neutral flag, Lazitskine, cleared 2 meters 01 to depose the USA's Vashti Cunningham, the winner in Portland, Oregon, 2 years ago. Cunningham cleared 1 meter 93, the same as Alessia Trost, but took silver ahead of the Italian on countback. This is Andy Edwards at the World Indoor Athletics Championships in Birmingham.
And now it's time for a Saturday music spot. Yes, time to relax and enjoy great African music.
Oga fluffy senti sinan merudi tandale. Meshindwa kulipa bima, nimeuza madale. Radio nyimbo mezima, TV ndio hatare. Meneja umebaki jina, nitakia tatale. Ole shabiki zangu, waloni sifu kwa maneno matamu. Leo matu zangu, ni mitusi tu kwa Instagramu. Kimwa na statangu, eti na yanifamu. Hata muna izi kimpigia, ananifukia kama salamu. Na magazeti nyumbani kwa kuku savari, sunajuaga. Utasikia tafarani timoni kwa zari, amemwagwa. Tabia ya kuwajibu sinaga. Kama naiona michambo ya matemu wa zamani nopitiaga. Nayo sema ya ramana, sababu wakuna anejua kesho. Anepanga ni rabana, ila mificha ni confidential. Ukisaliomba sana, mumeo nisije kwa kichekesho. Mana rafiki wa jana, dio adui mkubwa kesho. Chetapofika tama, kadiriki atajapo kuniposti. Pindisho zimekwama, nankipata si jasi ni mikosi. Oh, jasi imezama, mwana linusuru baba. Kama na mwana mwanangu, roo yangu, tifada mbote. Anakwenda na mamangu, kwa chaka kikweto na fukuzwa toke. Usilie sandrangu, mwani yangu, chikaze usichoke. Wana kesho zame yangu, vuma tena mambo ya nyoke. Hey, na magazeti nyumbani kwa kuku savari, sunajuaga. Utasikia tafarani timoni kwa zari, amemwago yelewi. Na vinye nilivyo nyonge tabia ya kwa jibu sinaga. Kama na yona michambu ya matemu wa zamani ya nikara. Saliomba sana, mumeo nisije kwa kichekesho. Mana rafiki wa jana, ndio adui mkubwa kesho.
Dagbe Mother land, whether you come here to request me, oh, I be not to find you. Baby, you're my jiggy jiggy. Unani pa gididi. come and go. Whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Another day, another goal. Another day to be a mighty warrior.
Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death,
I fear no evil.
Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death,
I'll be alright.
Yes, how about that? That was our Saturday music spot. I hope you enjoyed the music. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Saida Hamdun, and our engineer for tonight, Justin Twites, We thank you for joining us. See you tomorrow, Sunday. I'm Douglas Impuga.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A delegation from the U.S. government's Millennium Challenge Corporation, or MCC, visited Lesotho recently to discuss the development of a second MCC compact to reduce poverty and promote economic growth in partnership with the government of Lesotho. During their visit to restart development of a second MCC compact, the U.S. delegation met with senior Lesotho government officials and political party leaders, civil society, and the private sector to discuss MCC's approach to country partnership and the compact development process going forward. Using an approach that reflects a country's own priorities, MCC provides time-limited grants and assistance to developing countries that meet rigorous standards for good governance, from fighting corruption to respecting democratic rights. Working with local partners, MCC tackles some of the most pressing challenges that developing countries face, such as access to electricity, clean water, land rights, and roads. The decision by MCC's board of directors to reselect Lesotho is acknowledgement of the government of Lesotho's actions to address MCC's ongoing rule of law concerns, including the implementation of the Southern African Development Community recommendations, said Principal Deputy Vice President Kia Kim. Lesotho's continued commitment to rule of law, accountability, and investing in its people will remain important as we work toward our shared goal of reducing poverty through economic growth. U.S. Ambassador to Lesotho Rebecca Gonzalez noted, "The ongoing positive impact of the first MCC compact is a testament to the tremendous collaboration between the United States and Lesotho, and we look for the government of Lesotho's continued commitment to these early investments. As we build on this partnership of mutual accountability, we remain committed to supporting Lesotho as it undertakes an inclusive, transparent, and comprehensive national reform process, which is essential to achieving sustainable economic growth and long-term stability."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.